Hello and welcome to the International Intrigue Audio Newsletter. This is where we take our two main stories from this week's newsletter and read them out loud to you so you can fall peacefully to sleep. This week we've got two incredible stories for you. The first one is dear to my heart, and it's about Scottish independence. A recent election in the UK made it more likely that Scotland will push for independence soon. What does that mean for the rest of the UK? Our second story is about super forecasting and what the CIA can teach you. It's all about how to make better predictions in a volatile world. Without further ado, on to the first story.
Scottish Independence, Braveheart 2.0? This week, I turned to pop culture for research inspo on Scotland's potential secession from the United Kingdom, a play that's back on the cards following last Thursday's election victory of the pro-independence Scottish National Party. What began with a quick scroll through Netflix soon morphed into 10 hours of binge-watching Outlander and a tartan-clad me yelling, "Freedom!" from my couch. Look, I know he's a bit mad, but young Mel Gibson was hot. Watch Gallipoli and thank me later. The takeaway from this thorough investigation is that one should always back the Scots to defeat the English, and the success of this latest independence movement could spell the end of the 314-year-old English-Scottish Union and rock the broader UK. History brush-up, marriage of convenience. Scotland boasts fine cultural exports such as deep-fried Mars bars, Billy Connolly, and haggis, but perhaps it is most legendary for being a fierce and independent kingdom. Did you know that the Scots booted out the mighty Roman Empire in 103 AD? And we have the Justice League, yet no one thought of dusting off Rusty and Mel for a Maximus Decimus Meridius versus William Wallace crossover extravaganza? And did you know the Scots fought a series of victorious wars against the English to maintain Scottish independence in the 13th and 14th centuries? And finally, did you know that Scottish comedian Janie Godley single-handedly rebuffed a US invasion of her homeland in 2018? They won't tell you that last one in their history class. Okay, back to the olden days. So all was separate and peachy in the British Isles until 1603, when the death of the English Queen Elizabeth I transferred the English crown to Scottish King James VI, the OG Queen Lizzie's cousin. We swear all the European monarchs are related. As the King of Scotland and the King of England, James began what would be a 100-year political process of reuniting the two countries. The Kingdom of Great Britain was officially created by the Acts of Union in 1707. Back then, the Scots were not in great shape. The union with England delivered welcome economic support and political clout, particularly as England lined its coffers with the spoils from the Empire. Niall Ferguson is always a good read. Rising Scottish Nationalism and Brexit. Not every Scot welcomed the English Union in 1707. Calls for Scottish independence continued into the 20th century, reaching a peak in the 1960s and 70s after oil was discovered in the North Sea. Because Scotland was not independent, it didn't control royalties. It's Scotland's oil. That's the SNP political slogan circa 1974. Two following referendums established a system of home rule for the Scottish Parliament in 1999, which essentially granted the Scots more autonomy from the UK over some areas of governance. For example, Scottish responsibilities included agriculture, forestry, fishing, education and training, health and social services, and the environment, and the UK responsibilities included immigration, foreign policy, defence, employment, and maintaining a stiff upper lip. Alas, this devolved system wasn't enough to quell secession calls, so the Scots held a referendum in 2014 for total independence, which ended with a decisive loss for the pro-independence camp, and a smug then UK PM, David Cameron, who thought this issue had been settled once and for all. Lol. The Brexit result in 2016 rekindled Scotland's independence movement. 62% of Scots voted to remain in the EU, but the Brexit vote passed, leaving Scots miffed that their voices went unheard. Nicola Sturgeon, Scotland's popular First Minister and head of the pro-independence SNP, pounced on this swell of sentiment after Brexit. Now approximately 50% of Scots poll in favour of independence, and here we are today. The for and against of Scottish independence. It's all for nothing if you don't have freedom. Sir William Wallace, aka Braveheart. Aside from honouring the wishes of Sir Wallace, those fighting for independence argue that independence grants self-determination over political affairs to Scotland, like foreign policy and defence. Plus, Scotland would be represented in international organisations. Scots can exploit their own natural resources, such as the North Sea oil and gas reserves, which account for 64% of the EU's oil reserves and a whopping 96% of the UK's oil output. Independence would make life easier for Scottish exporters, particularly those in the fish and shellfish industries, which relied on free trade with the EU, which contributed about $20 billion to the economy annually. And Scotland could continue building its proud national identity, buttressed by what most countrymen believe to be a superior legal and educational system compared to their UK partners. Those against independence argue that Scotland's population of 5.5 million can better compete in a globalised world under the diplomatic, military and economic influence and security of Team UK, which is about 64 million people. And there's no real long-term plan for generating tax revenue after the UK's union handouts stop and Scotland's natural resources run dry. Scotland would invite the headache of deciding which currency to use, the pound, the euro, or a new Scottish currency. And finally, independence would hamper Scottish trade with England, its biggest trading partner. About 60% of all Scottish exports go to the UK, and restrict freedom of movement for people from both sides. But here's a really big question. What will happen to Balmoral Castle? For God's sake, won't anyone think of the Queen's holidays? Zoom out. What's next? The fight for Scottish independence has just begun. The SNP still needs to push the legislation for hashtag IndyRef2 through Scottish Parliament, hope that the Scots actually vote for it, and then get the legislation approved by the UK Parliament. If Scotland were to become independent, the UK would lose about a third of its territory and about 8% of its population and GDP. If those hurdles are cleared, Scotland faces a long road ahead. First up is a time-consuming and costly, about three times more than Brexit, renegotiated trade deal with the EU. If all that clears, there's a tedious admin task for state creation, like bolstering defence capabilities, striking independent trade and security deals with other countries, and building a physical border between Scotland and the UK. You know, doing things like passport checks, not Hadrian's Wall 2.0. The big question is, might a successful Scottish independence spark secession movements in Northern Ireland and Wales, or even inspire separatists further afield, such as in Catalonia? Scottish secession would be the biggest geopolitical challenge the UK has faced in generations. And never forget that with Boris at the helm, anything is possible.
Super forecasting. What you can learn from the CIA. As Professor Philip Tetlock said in 2014, the average expert was found to be only slightly more accurate than a dart-throwing chimpanzee. Many experts would have done better if they had made random guesses. What is super forecasting? Well, super forecasters are people who've proven to be even better than subject matter experts at predicting the future. So perhaps think of super forecasting as crowdsourcing, if the crowd didn't have its requisite village of idiots. Tetlock's book, Super Forecasting, explains how to super forecast, and I apologise, I'm going to have to say that word a lot during this. 1. Develop a forecasting competition. Ask employees to publicly assign probabilities to predictions about the future, with reasons for their assessments. 2. Keep score. According to the Good Judgment Project, measuring the accuracy of forecasts over time is the secret to understanding what works and what doesn't. Identify those people who have proven to be the best forecasters. You want a big enough group to have cognitive diversity. And 4, give your team of super forecasters specific and verifiable questions about the future. No, social media may become less influential over time nonsense. I wanted to see how this worked, so I signed up to become a forecaster for the Center of Security and Emerging Technology at Georgetown's Walsh School of Foreign Service. After a few questions about myself and a few more about my expertise, I was given a list of questions to answer. So I guess you can ignore what I said before about super forecasting being crowdsourcing sans idiot. Anyway, I chose to answer, will a G7 country boycott the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics before January 1, 2022? And we've got the results here in a graphic, but essentially I forecast there's a 10% chance of that, and the current crowd forecast is 20%. So I'm a little bit less likely. I think it's a little bit less likely that a G7 country will boycott the Beijing Winter Olympics than the crowd does. So does super forecasting work? Well, the truth is we don't really know. Super forecasting works well in experiments, but there's limited evidence as to how useful it is in practice. Yet, public organizations are turning to super forecasting to grapple with rising global uncertainty. The CIA, Downing Street, Czech government, and likely plenty of others have experimented with super forecasting. In fact, a few years ago, a former Australia ambassador hosted a forecasting competition among embassy staff. Presumably they excelled because it's always tomorrow in Australia. Sorry for that joke. Ray Dalio, the founder of the infamous hedge fund Bridgewater, arguably adapted the idea behind super forecasting to develop his trademark radical transparency principle. Some benefits of super forecasting. Super forecasts draw on a broad range of expertise and opinions. The process can remove the authority bias and involve all levels of an organization in decision making. The possibility of quantifying good judgment to develop verifiably better decision making processes. Some of the drawbacks, and based on my experience in government, I am very skeptical super forecasting could be routinely employed across any big bureaucracy. Employees are not likely to be enthusiastic about programs that highlight how poor they are at their job, causing serious cultural problems. Super forecasting exercises must be conducted by experienced managers to avoid cognitive biases. The process risks becoming a way for decision makers to pass the buck, i.e., oh, the super forecast told me to do it. None of that means that super forecasting is a bad idea. Just that even the best ideas often can't withstand the hot mess that is humans in large groups, aka organizational culture. So how can you use super forecasting in your organization? 1. Understand what the best forecasters have in common. It is the personality of super forecasters, rather than any specific knowledge, that allows them to be so accurate. They are brutally honest about their success. I got lucky. And untroubled by their failures. I can learn and get better. They are cautious, humble, and open-minded when researching an issue. They're analytical and good with numbers, without necessarily being statisticians. They have a collaborative win-win approach to sharing information and ideas. No one in your organization fit that bill? Luckily, forecasters are made, not born. A decision maker can improve their judgment from 36% better than random to 66% better than random with training and practice in forecasting. 2. Ensure decision makers understand how to use super forecasts. According to Tetlock, predictions made more than 5 years out are no better than chance. Add to that the fact that decision makers often don't understand probability, then you've got a recipe for forecasts being misinterpreted and misused. And I'm sad to say my former colleagues aren't much better. According to Nate Silver, when political experts described an event as absolutely certain, it failed to transpire an astonishing 25% of the time. So while super forecasts might add 10 or 15% accuracy to the predictions, they still can't tell you how to prepare for that predicted future. That's why one of the founding principles of international intrigue is that the world is getting more volatile, and decision makers of the future will need to understand how to respond. 3. Outsource your forecasts. Too small to build your own internal super forecasting team? Well, there are consulting firms that can either lend you a team of super forecasters or construct one for you. You heard it here first. Super forecasting as a service companies are going to be huge. Super forecasting is another tool, not an answer. Saying, show me the numbers, can be a crutch for poor managers. The fact is, the decisions that senior managers get paid to make rarely come down to a simple spreadsheet, no matter what Chad from finance says. On the other hand, I've learned to be suspicious of any decision maker who routinely refers to their good judgment or gut feel. Public institutions too often trust senior executives based solely on their years of experience. According to the Harvard Business Review in 2016, the sweet spot that organizations should focus on is forecasts for which some data, logic, and analysis can be used, but seasoned judgment and careful questioning also play key roles. My forecast? There is an 85% chance you'll hear the phrase super forecast in your organization before 2023, and 100% chance that if I'm wrong, I'll deny it. So there you have it, another week in the can. We hope you enjoyed our two main stories this week, and we would urge you to check out the newsletter in email form because it contains a lot of extra reading, links, and graphics that complete the stories. In other news, we got great feedback to last week's edition on Dan Wang and the Analyzing an Analyst series, so look out for more of those in the future. But for now, that's all from us. Until next week...